This afternoon I wanted to talk about gladness or gladdening the heart and to perhaps reflect upon some of the building blocks of gladness. I'd like to start with a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye. Some of you may be familiar with her work. It's called So Much Happiness. It's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there's something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands, like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches. And love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and the scratched records. Since there's no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way be known. I think for most of us, peace, happiness, contentment are experienced as being some of the most rare and precious gifts in our life. Sometimes seeming so hard to find. And yet in the moments when we glimpse them, it can feel as if our whole world is filled with ease. Now, unhappiness or discontent, I think we mostly experience when we're heroically striving to be something we're not, or sometimes heroically striving to make other people into something they're not, or when we're heroically striving to have something we don't have. And I think we begin to see at times that happiness is at times no further away from us than the next breath. Than opening our heart to the moment we're in and learning what it means to release this kind of striving. I think that the really timeless teaching of this tradition is that life doesn't have to be perfect for us to find peace. That our minds and hearts don't have to be perfect for us to find peace. That our meditation certainly doesn't have to be perfect for us to find peace. But peace does have, I think, a price. Or happiness, we might say, asks something of us. That it does ask us to give up this kind of endless endeavor to snatch at what is not, to grab hold of something that is not, to give up the ongoing tendency to resist and to fear. When you read the story of the Buddha, I think it's very important to read the very human story of Siddhartha, who was so much like us. You know, we can imagine that Siddhartha just kind of had this easeful path into enlightenment. Actually, he stumbled along the way, like most of us do. And in that stumbling along the way, Siddhartha spent really quite a few years undertaking ascetic practices, abusing his body, starving himself, trying to trounce his mind, suppression, resistance, aversion, the whole spectrum of things that I think we can all relate to. And what was it in the service of? It was in the service of trying to endeavor to transcend this imperfect world, trying to make it go away. When we come here to spend a day like we've been doing today, it can be quite challenging because we meet so directly everything that feels so imperfect. But there's an added ingredient. There's nowhere to hide. There's nowhere to hide. So, you know, there's nowhere to hide from our bodies. You know, there's nowhere really to hide from our minds, although we can be fairly creative about it. There's nowhere to hide from what's happening in our meditation. And I think sometimes when we have that kind of sincerity and courage to turn towards that so directly, you know, at first it can feel disheartening. And we tell ourselves that all the stories we've heard about how impossible meditation is are all true. And we tell ourselves that all of our lurking suspicions about this path and the people who practice in it being grim and somber and miserable, that they surely are all true. And then we might remember that the Buddha never taught that this is a path of misery leading to the deepest misery, but that this is a path of happiness leading to the highest happiness. And the Buddha described the highest happiness as peace. Contrary to what we may assume, the Buddha spoke so often of joy, of the gladdened heart, spoke about the happiness that is born of the collected mind. And quite honestly, this is one of the great benefits of cultivating practices of one-pointedness, or cultivating most practices of meditation. Because as your practice deepens, what inevitably people discover is that there lies within their own hearts and minds such a source and wealth of inner happiness and joy that there is nothing actually that can be gained that can actually really compare to that depth of inner joy and happiness. You know, most people who spend years hanging out on meditation cushions are not doing it in the pursuit of misery. They are doing it because they know that that is true, that within their own hearts and minds there is such a wellspring of joy, inwardly generated. The Buddha spoke about the happiness that is born of seclusion, the joy that is born of loving kindness, of compassion, of equanimity. And he spoke mostly about the joy of the liberated heart, the joy of the liberated mind. Now, I think sometimes when we hear this or respond to this, we can still at times tend to be rather dualistic in our approach and sometimes think that first we have to suffer in order to be happy later. You know, that first we have to get to grips with the really difficult stuff and that afterwards we will be happy. I mean, I know there was a time when I practiced in India, you know, for a long time. This was a kind of prevailing belief system. So the more we were miserable, the more virtuous we felt, you know, the more we were kind of like really moaning and groaning and feeling absolutely depressed, the more we believed we were purifying. And that we were sort of getting rid of these sort of deep, you know, deep impurities. And, you know, I think it was a kind of a sort of our own form of ascetic practice. And it took me a long time to really, really see how actually I was perpetuating something in that very attitude. It was almost like perpetuating that neural groove, you know. Misery became my companion. Personally, I think it's not a helpful belief system to feel that first we struggle and then at some mystical point later on in the path we become very happy. How much in this teaching the Buddha put together path and fruition? Path and fruition. You know, we practice calmness. Calmness is a fruition. You know, we practice gladdening the heart. A gladdened heart is a fruition. You know, we practice collectedness. One-pointedness is a fruition. We practice freedom, and liberation is a fruition. These two are always very much paired together. Personally, I think it is far more helpful to ask of ourselves the question, what does it mean for us to have our practice develop and unfold in a climate of happiness? What is needed for us to cultivate in order to feel that our practice is unfolding in a climate of inner gladness and well-being? And I think that's something very much it's helpful to take almost as a koan, as a kind of question into our lives. There's a very interesting instruction that the Buddha gave. He said, well, actually it was just a statement. The Buddha said that in a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. Isn't that interesting? In a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. I've reflected on that a lot, and what I see in myself, like if my mind is in a place of struggle, if it's really, you know, if I was worrying about something or preoccupied with something, the capacity to be attentive is deeply, almost impossible. So instead of seeing happiness as kind of the outcome of being attentive and present, the Buddha is suggesting that we actually put this in the foreground as the forerunner. Put happiness as the forerunner to wise attention. To me, that's a very interesting reversal. Now, in this practice, wise attention is the place where all of us begin. But as I've emphasized so much today, it's how we pay attention. You know, I mean, have you seen yourself paying attention and you're kind of like a hammer? You know, it's like you're a hammer with a nail. You know, come back, you know. Come back, you know. Come back, you know. Feel that breath, you know. It's kind of like, no, what does that feel? Is that very easeful? You know, it's not easy. It's how we pay attention, which is so, so important. But we see its value because we really see how the mind that is at ease, the mind that knows how to find a refuge in calmness, is the mind that is inclined towards very profound insight. We see that our capacity for compassion, for kindness, mostly arises out of a mind that feels present, still, balanced, and calm. And we know in our own experience that to really be able to listen to anything wholeheartedly, to see anything wholeheartedly, to be able to be touched by anything wholeheartedly, we actually really need to know what it means to be present, to be attentive, to be here. So today, what we have begun really to do, breath by breath, step by step, moment by moment, is really to cultivate our capacity to be present and attentive. And as we do this, I think it's so important to stay close to that reflection that in a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. Now, I'm sure one of the first things you've noticed today is very much what I was speaking about earlier, that there is an intrinsic kind of tension involved in cultivating wise attention, because very often we just don't want to be here. Our mind just doesn't want to be here. It wants to be somewhere else. It wants to be at the movies. It wants to be in tomorrow. It wants to be in yesterday. It wants to be in our plans and our fantasies and, you know, our rehearsals and our anxieties. And that, isn't that a familiar tension in our lives? How often we experience, we just don't want to be here. Now, there's some variation in that. Now, you probably will have noticed that we're really happy to be present and be attentive when things are pleasant. When you fell in love, probably nobody had to shout at you to pay attention. You know, when we watch a sunset, you know, when we listen to a piece of beautiful music, when we eat a wonderful meal, when we're with someone that we really care about. We are there without ever wanting to be somewhere else. If today in the meditation, you know, you felt yourself to be on the edge of enlightenment and having some amazing, blissful meditative experience, I bet you'd be glued to your cushion. No, you wouldn't need that sort of inward encouragement about, you know, just show up, come back, you know. It's that you'd have to be dragged out of the meditation hall. You notice that we pay attention to the unpleasant or the difficult often only when it doesn't feel like there's any alternative. When we have exhausted all of our strategies of avoidance and distractedness, then we might say, reluctantly, begrudgingly, be present with this. And you notice when something is neutral, and a lot of life falls in that category, of neither being extremely pleasant or unpleasant, mostly our attention just slides away. We become dismissive. So here is the first tension, or we might even say the first insight in the practice, is really to know the difference between this kind of captivated attention and what is wise attention. And I know in the Tibetan tradition, they often call this a kind of childlike concentration. You know, that kind of concentration that's kind of entranced by the baubles, you know, and the lights and the, you know, the bells and the smells. Now, for me, I think I would define wise attention really as the willingness to attend to all things with equal respect. So it's not just about equally, with equal respect, that we are willing to bring a respectful attentiveness to the difficult and the challenging as much as to the pleasant or to that which falls in between. Now, to me, that change of attitude involves considerable insight, because that's not so necessarily so familiar to us. But that change in attitude, the willingness to attend to all things with equal respect, you know, the sound of the siren, the sound of the bird, with equal respect, that is what allows this tension to be creative rather than demoralizing. So within the body of mindfulness, of breathing, within the body of being mindful of the body, we explore what it means to gather and to collect ourselves. We begin to explore what it means to be able to bring this respectful attention. And we're also exploring what it means to gladden our hearts and minds. So I wanted to look at some of the building blocks of happiness, certainly as it's understood within Buddhist teaching. The first of the building blocks, interestingly, of happiness in this tradition is generosity. Generosity of heart. And that's very much broken down. Certainly the Buddha didn't just talk about material generosity. He talked about the generosity, the gift of fearlessness. the gift of fearlessness, and the gift of living in accord with what is true, the gift of the Dharma. Now, I'm sure that if we look at our own experience, it becomes pretty apparent to us that when we are withholding, when we are holding on to anything incredibly tightly, whether it's an opinion, whether it's my space, whether it's my meditation cushion, you know, whether it's my practice, whether it's my anything. Whenever we're holding on to anything tightly, the effect on our heart and mind is fairly instant of becoming and feeling very contracted and defensive. Becoming actually quite fearful. Staking out the territory of mine. Staking out the territory of me. The effect of it is actually to become almost instantly unhappy. I'm sure we've also experienced in any moment when we're able to let go of that contractedness out of kindness, out of compassion, to let go of the territorial aspect of me and mine, we immediately feel much more at ease within ourselves, within life, within the world. We immediately feel less fearful. I think there is real questions about how, not only about how we are generous with others, but about how we are generous with ourselves in this practice and teaching. Now, to me, being generous to ourselves, which is another word for being kind to ourselves, does not mean that every time we encounter a difficulty, we get on our phone and order a pizza. You know? It doesn't mean that every time, you know, we hit a block in the road, we turn on our phone or we go to sleep. To me, this is not what is meant by generosity towards ourselves. I think mostly we learn to practice generosity and kindness to ourselves in learning to let go of discontent and contractedness, which again is so often found, if you look at it, it's often found in the struggle to be what, to have what is not in this moment, or the struggle for us to be what we are not in this moment. Contractedness and a lack of generosity is usually found in this rejection of what is. This aversion to what is. So in this practice of mindfulness, we really learn to cultivate generosity and contentment moment to moment. We learn, what does it mean to be at peace with this achy knee? It's really understanding that peace as we understand it here, or happiness as we understand it here, is always relational. It's not some disassociated state, you know, of happiness or peace over there. Meanwhile, the rest of the world is just kind of, you know, cut off. It's relational. What does it mean to be at peace with this aching knee? What does it mean to be at peace with this grumpy mind? You know, what does it mean to be at peace with my restless neighbor? In the Tibetan tradition, it's a kind of very simple story about this king, you know, who actually, by the standards of India at that time, you know, really had it pretty good, you know, because he was a king. If you were a king, you already had it good. But this king could never be happy because the other kings had more, you know, more cows, you know, more wives, actually at that time, you know. They always had more. They had more land. So this king, actually, unlikely as it seems, was named King Hard to Please. King Hard to Please. Now, this always makes me smile, actually, because I do a little bit of translation on this and think about how many times I might be occupying the role of Princess Hard to Please, you know, or you know, Prince Hard to Please. And it kind of reframes a little bit about what can go on in our mind. How often we meet this mind of refusal. The mind of refusal, refusing to be with what is. you know, you might have come here, you know, expecting some far out meditation center, you know, and what do you get? You know, you get a gym mat. You know, you might go on retreat, you expect to be in the Hilton, you know, and you've got a foam slab and difficult people all around you, you know. And how often we're in that mind of refusal, you know, this is not allowed to be. This is not allowed to be as it is. Now, I sometimes reflect, I mean, can you imagine, have you ever met a person who has always consistently lovely thoughts, who has always consistently a body that delights them, who is always consistently surrounded by amazing, fantastic people who admire them, who only has uplifting emotions? I know I have never met that person. And my sense is that that person has never existed in human history. And I'm actually fairly confident at this point that I'm not going to be the first. That's a good point to come to. That's a really good point to come to. I'm not going to be the first. I'm not going to reinvent human consciousness. I'm not going to reinvent the world. I am not going to be the first. So where does that leave me? Well, that leaves me either in an ongoing battle with an imperfect world that I cannot always control, or it leaves me with the invitation perhaps to look at what's going on in my own mind and how I am actually going to move from this mind of refusal to a mind that is inclusive, to a heart and a mind that is actually established in an inner peace, in an inner joy, and in an inner equanimity. Meeting this imperfect world, we are asked to find gladness. It is not the fact that we don't get what we want or become who we want to be that causes contraction. It is the wanting and the demanding that causes contractedness. So with generosity, we are learning to let go of some of that wanting and demanding. Kabir, he put it in one of his poems. He said, "I said to this wanting creature inside me, 'What is this river you want to cross? Do you believe there is some place that will make the heart less thirsty? In that great absence, you will find nothing. Enter into your own body. There you have a place to rest. Throw away the thought of imaginary things and stand firm in that which you are.'" Generosity is found in our willingness to let go of preoccupations, our obsessions endlessly about how things should be. As they say in the Tibetan tradition, preoccupations do not end until we die, but they end when we put them down. There is so much, isn't there, that we can worry about, so much we can be anxious about, so much that we can plan for, so much that we can regret. Does our obsessions actually make any difference to anything? Or do they only make us agitated? I think of obsession a little bit like chewing gum. You know, you ever had that experience when you first chew gum? It really, kind of tastes pretty good, you know, and you're sort of quite happily chomping away. Now, you notice after a while it loses its flavor. If you weren't allowed to take it out, you know, you're just chomping away and there's all piece of gum going on and on and on, and you're in the habit of chomping, maybe hoping the flavor's going to reappear. Or what if we didn't really do, we take that old piece out, we put momentarily it's juicy fruit, you know, until the same thing happens again. You know, isn't that what obsession is like? We're just chomping away. There's no good outcome from it. There's no good outcome from it. Instead, what it does is it kind of diminishes gladness. And there's an undercurrent in anxiety and busyness and obsession. And please be aware, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha used the word obsession, and he had quite a high bar, you know, thinking the same thought more than once. Anyway, that's quite a high bar to aim for, you know. That's the one we're going for. But with generosity, out of kindness, out of compassion, we are learning to put obsession down. Learning to lighten the load, learning to lighten the burden that we feel that we can carry so often. And how do we do that? Well, you know, we do it so simply. We come back just to remember this breath. We come back just to this moment of being present in our body. You know, we come back to the simplicity of listening. We come back to the simplicity of breathing. You know, not because there's something, because every time we're coming back from something. And very often what we're coming back from is the chewing gum. And there's a tremendous art of generosity we are learning in that. Not just the mechanics of coming back, but the generosity of learning to take the gum out. Learning to step out of the obsessive mind that can feel so contracted. The second part of generosity is so much the gift of fearlessness. You know, and certainly this is both outwardly and inwardly. Outwardly, it's often expressed as offering a refuge to those who have no place of safety, to protecting those who have no friend, to have no protection, to being a friend to those who have no friends. That aspect of generosity. But the gift of fearlessness is also something that we offer inwardly. Because, you know, in this teaching, aversion and fear are said to be part of the same cloth. Two threads of the same cloth are aversion and fear. And when we are aversive or fearful, we turn away from what is. And very often we do that inwardly. You think about how many times we turn away from our own thoughts, the emotions, the experiences that are difficult to be with, how often we turn away from ourselves through condemnation, through judgment, through blame, through shame, through comparison, through evaluation, that in all of those moments we're actually turning away from ourselves out of fear, out of aversion. So there's so much in this teaching, this practice, where we're learning to offer that gift of fearlessness to our own being, to learn what it means to be a refuge to ourselves. And we do that, I think, very simply by cultivating a practice of non-abandonment. You know, each time again that we come back, each time that we're willing to befriend what is going on in our bodies, to befriend what is going on in our minds, our hearts, we're actually cultivating a culture and a practice of non-abandonment, attending to the wandering thought, attending to, just as we would attend to our shuffling neighbor, attending to the pain of our knee, attending to what arises as it is. You know, it's sometimes said that the world is full of choices, but at times the only choice we actually have is the attitude we are going to bring to this moment. Whether it is going to be one of aversion or whether it is going to be one of befriending and fearlessness. Another of the building blocks of gladness is said to be mudita, or appreciative joy. In fact, in Pali, the word mudita translates as a heart of gladness. A heart of gladness. There's a saying in the Zen tradition I like very much. It says, although I am in Kyoto when the cuckoo sings, I long to be in Kyoto. Although I'm in Kyoto when the cuckoo sings, I long to be in Kyoto. Appreciative joy is about, it's really about recognizing we are in Kyoto. We're already there. Appreciative joy is learning to delight, to welcome all that is lovely, all that has the capacity to make our hearts sing. It's learning to welcome also the aching back and the wayward mind, the moments of doubt. When all of that is going on, you know, when we're filled with disappointment or doubt or restlessness, we're sure we're far from Kyoto, aren't we? How is it positive? We're miles from Kyoto. And yet, have you noticed that the more indignant you become, the more insulted and offended you feel about being far from Kyoto, the more tight and contracted you find yourself to be? I spoke about this morning, you know, how easy it is for us to focus only on that which is flawed and imperfect and broken inwardly and outwardly. And in those moments, gladness feels very far away. Feels very much to be replaced by contractedness. It is true that all that is broken and flawed surely needs attention. Beneath the attention of care, needs the attention of kindness and compassion. It needs the intention of embracing, including. Because when there is aversion, we don't attend to what is broken. I have always found that nature is a great ally in beginning to taste that sense of gladness. You know, when you allow yourself, when you really pay attention and you really allow yourself to be touched, you know, by the flowers that are beginning to grow in spring, by the sight of a bird in the sky, by the sound of the wind, when we take the time to illuminate our world with mindfulness, it can open those closed doors. It can open the closed doors, and our heart can be touched. And it is in that heart of spaciousness, of gladness, that actually the broken can be cared for. In mindfulness practice, there is a very major shift in attitude or an understanding that is asked of us. Because I think conventionally there is a belief that our happiness depends upon someone or something making us happy. It is a belief that externalizes both the source of happiness and the source of suffering. And when you look at what we do in mindfulness practice, you really see that we are awakening our capacity to be delighted. We're not seeking for more things to delight us, but we are awakening our capacity to be delighted. We are awakening our capacity to appreciate. We're awakening our capacity to be touched. There's nothing very complex about this. You know, we awaken that capacity to be delighted through the wholeheartedness that we learn to develop in the way that we are present in our life. We learn to celebrate blessings. We learn to celebrate blessings. This is not kind of Pollyanna-ish, you know, pretending that everything in the world is sweet and gooey and lovely. But there is something about learning to balance. You know, as much as we hold the broken, to hold that which is actually a blessing. You know, I remember years ago, you know, because, you know, I come from a long lineage of aversive people, you know, I have no problem with confessing that, you know. So I have a long, you know, I come very well, you know, inherited, I have a big legacy, you know, of, you know, just figuring out what's wrong with the world, you know. So, you know, no wonder I was drawn to Buddhism. You know, I heard about suffering, I felt right at home, you know. But to really notice the tendency not to continue that lineage, you know. And so I remember years ago, you know, I was co-teaching a retreat with a friend of mine, and he has rather a sunny disposition. You know, he always looks at the world, he always sees what's wonderful, you know, he's terrific. He's always a smile on his face, you know, very cheerful kind of character, you know. So I find very interesting when I'm teaching with him, you know. And I remember arriving one morning, you know, and I was kind of like a little grumpy, you know. And you know, he started on this long list of questions, you know, like, do you have enough to eat this morning? I said, yes. Are your children well? Yes, you know. Look, you know, you're able to walk. Isn't that fantastic? Great, yes, you know. Did your car work this way? Yes, you know, you didn't get stopped in a traffic jam. No, you know. And every question, I could feel myself getting, you know, like this little bit happier, you know, just a little bit happier. But I realized it wasn't an induced happiness. He was only pointing out what I wasn't paying attention to. He was actually only pointing out what was actually there. And notice how, you know, the shape of our mind becomes the shape of our world, doesn't it? You probably noticed that. You know, if we feel very anxious, the whole world looks threatening, doesn't it? You know, and if we're feeling pretty aversive, this whole world just feels rotten. You know, and there can also be a way that that's promotion. I mean, as much as I, you know, love my friend with the sunny disposition, I also clearly have a memory of, you know, sitting down once with an insurance salesman. You know, wanted to sell me insurance, who went through a very similar, you know, a different list of questions, you know. You know, you realize your children could die any time, you know, and your house could burn down, you know. And what about floods? Have you thought about floods, you know? And you know, you very likely you're going to get cancer at some point in your life, you know. And I was getting kind of like more and more anxious every moment, you know, because it was all in the service he wanted me to insure against this. And I really thought, what's my best insurance against this? It's to know how to be with what is. To know how to be with what is. To develop that inner capacity, the inner equanimity, the inner refuge, where we offer to ourselves the gift of fearlessness, but we also nurture our capacity for appreciation. Because we see so much when our heart is closed, the world is really closed to us. When we don't see fully and wholeheartedly, there's very little that can touch us. And when our mind is weary and tired, everything looks dark and tired. And our practice here is to really to begin to enliven our own hearts. To begin to enliven our own hearts. Rumi, he put it in a poem once. He said, today, like every other day, we wake up empty and frightened. Don't open the door to the study and begin reading. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. Hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. The last, I think, of the great allies of gladness that I just want to touch on is the cultivation of spaciousness. There's one of the monks in the Ajahn Chah tradition. He when Ajahn Chah was dying, he decided he was going to go and make one last visit to Ajahn Chah and to ask of him, or to come up with the question that he'd never asked, you know, the most important question. And so he arrived, and he said, you know, he asked Ajahn Chah, he says, you know, what are the last words of wisdom that you could leave me with? And Ajahn Chah said to him, he said, I want you to know the difference between the mind and the activities of the mind. And at first, this guy said he felt really disappointed. You know, like he'd gone there for this last priceless, timeless teaching. And this is what he got told. Know the difference between the mind and the activities of the mind. And then he said when he reflected on this, he really began to understand what a remarkable teaching that was. Because it was really a teaching of spaciousness. It's really a teaching of spaciousness. If you put it in a different context, like you notice when you come into a room like this room or any other room, how immediately our attention is drawn to everything in the room, you know, the flowers, the lights, the windows, the furniture. How often do we really notice the space in the room? You notice when you sit, how easily our attention is drawn to the thoughts, the images, the memories. Do we notice the awareness in which all of that is actually arising and passing? When you go to listening, do you notice how easily the attention is drawn looking for sounds, as if we need a sound in order to listen? Do we actually notice the silence from which the sounds arise and merge back into? It's about noticing the difference between the mind and the activities of the mind. And really beginning to cultivate that sense of spaciousness, knowing that sometimes we don't notice it. We don't notice that sense of spaciousness because we get so mesmerized by the things in the space. It's much more subtle to pay attention to the space, but you can find in that spaciousness a tremendous sense of ease and the room to include everything without being overwhelmed by anything at all. It takes not only a certain subtlety of attention, it also takes patience. Really takes so much patience. The patience to always be a beginner, the patience to always come back, the patience to pick up what we have forgotten, the patience to remember. But that patience in itself is such a gift of kindness and gladdens our heart. We are never at ease if we're always living and waiting for something to begin or for something to end. But we can find the ease of being with what is. Gladness is like a fabric with many threads. Patience, kindness, fearlessness, the willingness to be with what is, the willingness to be wholehearted, the willingness to be present. But these are all qualities that we cultivate, and this path is all about what we are bringing into being. About bringing into being all that which is ennobling, that brings a sense of nobility, of uprightness, of poise and authenticity.